The year that this week's album was released, the American public confronted two different demons, Tricky Dick Nixon and the William Friedkin film, The Exorcist. One of them possessed those around him with his evil spirit, spewed profanity behind closed doors, and created an existential crisis that still haunts us to this day. The other is called Pazuzu and was featured heavily in the Friedkin picture. This week's album is only four tracks long and yet garnered the distinction of being the highest selling jazz album until the year 1976, when George Benson blew onto the scene with his landmark album, Reason. See what I did there? This week's artist won an Academy Award for the score of the film Around Midnight about jazz musicians Lester Young and Bud Powell. A legend scoring a film about legends. I've got a new film on my to-watch list. Have you guessed it yet? The year was 1973. The album is Headhunters. The artist is the inimitable Herbie Hancock. Today on Two Dudes in Tunes. Welcome, one and all, to the podcast called Two Dudes in Tunes, the podcast where two longtime pals take turns talking about albums that astound and amaze. I'm one of the pals. My name is Chris Robinson, and the pal sitting across the internet from me is Wood Johnson. Wood, do you have enough Advil or booze in your system to get through this week's episode?
A little bit of both. Yes, I do.
Oh, you're not supposed to mix them. That's like a classic rock disaster waiting to happen.
Well, you know, whatever.
You're treating it the way Lucille Bluth treats the no alcohol on her medication thing, as just like a little winky face.
As it turns out, she had gotten up early and had taken pain medication because of a hangover-related headache. However, she mistook the drowsy eye alcohol warning for a winking eye alcohol suggestion.
Hey, if there's any parent I learned more about being a parent from, it has to be Lucille.
Oh, I feel so bad for your son, Maverick. So which son is he going to turn into? Job, Michael, or is he going to turn into...
Buster.
The third one's Buster. Thank you. Hey, brother.
We can only hope for a Michael.
Yeah, I don't know. The ignorance is bliss argument would say that it's probably best to be Job, like to just be striving for greatness that you will never achieve and have no idea you're not going to achieve it.
Illusion, Michael.
I mean, he did make a yacht disappear, but he also like had to blow it up and sink it the night before. I don't remember. Spoilers for a like 10-year-old show. Probably what, 12, 13 years old at this point, right?
Every bit of it, yeah.
Yeah, man.
What's new with you, man? But,
not much. A lot of work, a lot of scoping out house owning, like things that we're going to want to do. We've gotten a lot of rain, and we don't own a lawnmower or a weed whacker. And so... in the words of that one musician whose name escapes me right now, it's a jungle out there. He's the guy who's done like Toy Story and all those things. You know who I'm talking about?
Randy Newman.
Yes, in the words of Randy Newman.
From the theme song for Monk.
Yes, thank you, thank you. This would be a terrible podcast if it were just me, because not only would that be terribly boring, but also it would be a lot of like, oh, what's his name? Hold on, let me Google that. But the one thing that's worth bringing up, I have some stuff in here that is like boring and not very interesting, but the most hilarious thing is that today is Megan and I's 9th anniversary of being married. And
what are you doing recording a podcast with me?
Well, because both of us forgot until like this morning. We woke up and we were like, hey, we've been married for 9 years today. but we're having some friends over tomorrow to kind of relax and show off our house and stuff. And so we did some cleaning. Megan's kind of wrapping up the cleaning, and she was very gracious and said, go ahead and do the podcast.
And you told me before we started rolling that tonight's salsa night.
Yes, it is. Well, it's make the salsa, let it sit in the fridge and get real good, and then have it tomorrow night. So I'm super excited about that. Other than that, man, not a whole lot. What about you? You have had a heck of a week.
It has been a rough week in the Johnson household. So our grass, like up there in Lubbock, it has been raining just basically nonstop for weeks, and it'll rain for a day or so, and then it'll dry out a little bit and then rain again. So our grass had gotten to be about waist high.
And
there was
kind of this
2-day break in the weather. It was like, I have to mow the grass on Saturday. If we don't get it mowed, it's supposed to rain all next week. And so Saturday morning rolled around and it was drizzling. And I went out there and I mowed the lawn anyway. And by the time I got to the front yard, I started in the backyard and worked my way around. By the time I got to the front yard, it was pouring rain, like just drenching rain. But we got the lawn mowed. It's 5 days later and I need to mow again. Like, it's already taller than our HRA allows. So,
oh man, y'all have a homeowners association
that loves sending me letters. It's the greatest part of my week.
Oh, I'm sure.
But then, after I got the lawn mowed, we went to our favorite brewery on Saturday and kind of hit out there for a little bit. It's named Cactus Land, so shout out to them. It's out in the middle of kind of nowhere and beautiful views. And so we did that. And then we went to a distillery here in San Antonio because I had ran out of my desk bottle over here from when we're recording this podcast. So went there to buy a new bottle. And while we were there, we did a tasting. And I was sitting at a picnic table. And this is like 5 hours after I'd mowed the yard and done a couple of other things. I'm just sitting there relaxing, having a good time. And I leaned over to say something to Tiffany about, you know, the people behind us, because I was people watching and eavesdropping.
Oh, that's the best.
And my back popped.
All part of the friendly service here at Albatross. Ow! Oh, big time hurt. Ah, back. Oh, it's out.
And I like instantly couldn't breathe.
Oh, no.
And so like I threw my back out sitting at a picnic table.
And so how big was the tankard of whiskey that you were consuming? Was it like 2-hand Viking jug or what?
I wish it had been. It was little tiny serving cups for a flight. No. But anyhow, so
that's fantastic.
So we hit up Olive Garden and got to go Olive Garden on the way home. And it was Tiffany was supposed to work Sunday, Monday, and I was supposed to have Maverick all weekend. And here I am, like I can barely stand up straight, let alone do stuff with the baby. And she ate and I didn't really have an appetite because I was in pain. And she got food poisoning and it was like the worst case of food poisoning.
Oh my gosh.
So we both ended up laid up in bed all weekend. She had to call in sick and we kind of,
that's terrible.
Sicklings tried to take care of our baby as best as possible.
Oh no.
So really it ended up being kind of a miserable weekend, but there were some benefits to that. I mean, we got to spend a lot of time together. Neither of us really wanted to watch TV or anything like that. And so just kind of lounging around the house and taking it easy, we were able to spend some pretty good quality time together and hang out with the baby. And then not to go on and on and on and on. I'm skipping half the things in my notes because this week has just been so crazy. But I'm kind of excited. I was approached earlier this week about a potential job opportunity within my same company. And so I submitted all the paperwork for it today and I'm hoping to get an interview sometime next week. We'll see. So I'll keep you up to date on that.
Yeah, that's excellent. I'm excited for you. That's really good. I'm glad that there was a bright side to being laid up in bed with a thrown out back, having to take care of a baby. It's bad enough being sick when you don't have an important obligation like children.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I can only imagine that, like, Maverick's Does he still qualify as a newborn? What's the cutoff for that?
He's 7.5 months old, and he does not qualify as a newborn because he's he sits up on his own. He's fully mobile. We have this like mobile like baby pin that you set up. It's like little wall panels, and it snaps together kind of like Legos to kind of contain him.
Yeah,
and we've taken to calling it Thunderdome.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love it.
We put him down there in Thunderdome, and he basically crawls circles around the thing, patrolling its perimeter, and plays with his little toys and makes lots of noise. He's a definite boy. Like, he makes a lot of noise.
That's amazing.
So.
Yeah, I've been told by my parents that I didn't just spend a ton of time crying, but I definitely would just like make noise to hear myself talk.
Loud noises.
And so now I have a podcast where it's like structured at least somewhat.
Well, and he never cries. If he cries, something is wrong. But he's always babbling. And his new favorite thing to do is whenever you talk to him or call him by his name, he blows a raspberry at you. Just
that's amazing. I love it.
It's like, I'm not sure that's the kind of response we want from a respectful child, but hey.
Oh, man, that has the potential to be like a lot of detentions and suspensions in his future, but also like a lot of good times, I'm sure. So you take the good with the bad.
Well, and one more little bit of small talk to talk about, not to overshadow your anniversary or anything, but this is the 20th episode, man.
It is. I feel like it's a landmark, but I also feel like it's not. Yeah. Just because we've had no grand, like, it's not like we hit 20 episodes and it was like, oh man, look at all these downloads and articles being written about us. Not that that's the point, but like, I feel like 20 episodes feels like a lot more than it is. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Honestly, I'm the one who's been doing most of the editing on these. And so I look at kind of the time invested so far, just in the back end production side of things. And it feels like a pretty big achievement just in terms of the amount of content we've created in the amount of time that we've been creating it. You know, we've got a couple in the backlog. We're always ready. If we have to miss a week, there's an episode ready to go out while we're tied up with something else. And so looking at it, it feels like a pretty big accomplishment, but like you, it's kind of like, all right, it's 20 episodes out of the 50 we said we were going to do when we started this. Mm-hmm. So kind of looking at it from the aspect of, hey, we're almost halfway there and I'm still enjoying it. Like, it's still one of the highlights of the week. It's kind of cool to look at how many episodes we've done and the vast array of content. Like, today's episode is no different. It seems like we hit a couple of mainstream albums and then boom, something just off the charts pops up and it reinvigorates the whole conversation. So it's cool to see how we've ping-ponged around or pinballed around the genres, if you will.
Yeah, it's funny that you bring that up because this album really is pretty different fare from what we normally do. And I think the last thing we did that departed from like a typical pop structured album was probably Holst, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what was that, like six episodes ago? Five, six episodes ago?
Yeah, it was episode 15. Like that. So.
Yeah. But what I'm curious,
before you say anything else, we need to introduce the album. We're talking about Headhunters, October 26, 1973.
I read the spiel at the beginning and completely forgot that we should probably lead our listeners in a direction at some point. So yes, Headhunters by Herbie Hancock, October 26th, 1973. This is our first jazz album, is it not? I'm pretty sure it is.
It's our first true jazz album. We've done some jazzy albums, but this is
there's definitely some other
pointed jazz album.
Yeah, yeah. So what did you think of it? What was your experience with it? Like, was this your first time listening to it?
This was my first time listening to a complete Herbie Hancock album. I'd heard different tracks of his over the years. I know that I'd heard Chameleon before this, and Sly, I'd definitely heard before. But for me, it was the first time sitting down and really listening to a complete composition of his music. And I got to be honest, my first impression was kind of like a stereotypical experimental jazz. Second impression was this is something really special, and I really, really enjoyed it overall. In fact, I enjoyed it enough that I ended up listening to the complete This Is Herbie Hancock playlist on Spotify, which is like 78 tracks. So I ended up really diving into his music this week and really getting into it. And it's cool. You know, this is a pretty early album in his repertoire. I think his first album came out in 61 or 62. So here we are in 73. It's still pretty early. And even by 73, he was already considered kind of a legend in the current jazz scene. And since 73, to see the evolution of his music and his adoption of new techniques and new styles and experimenting with new things, including some really innovative early computer modeling for sound effects and stuff. It's really cool to see somebody like that who, even though he's, you know, in his 80s today, he's still innovating and playing with different, you know, riffs and ideas. So I really enjoyed it. We listened to this. We were laid up in bed and neither of us wanted to watch TV. And I was like, I have to listen to this album. So Sunday afternoon, Tiffany, Maverick, and I listened to it in our living room on like our home theater system, which I never listened to albums on, but it sounds pretty good. It was like, yay.
Oh, that's awesome. And, that sounds like fun.
And I have a 90-pound German Shepherd who's like the protector of the house. She thinks she's in charge. Her name is Zelda because all good video game princesses deserve to be named after a dog.
I love it.
So Zelda spent the whole album sitting there staring at the sound bar with her head tilted one way or the other, just constantly.
She was trying to figure out, like, what is this? What is going on? That's so funny.
But yeah, so, and Tiffany doesn't generally listen to the albums when I'm listening to them for the first time. And so it was kind of funny to get her reaction and experience at the same time I was getting it. But we'll get into that a little bit later, I think.
I was about to ask, but I won't if you're going to get into it later. Yeah, it's as far as Hancock's career goes, man, he's done everything. Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned in the blurb up top, and that's not the only film he's scored. I'm almost positive he's scored a couple of other ones. I know he did the most recent Pixar movie, right?
He has Soul. He has a writing credit on it.
Okay.
So he was a consultant for it, but you can definitely tell that he has a lot of impact into the direction that they were going with that movie. That is a phenomenal movie, by the way. If you haven't seen it, you have to watch it.
Shame on me. I haven't seen it yet. I think I get Pixar overload, but that's like a completely different discussion.
I feel like the last couple of years with Pixar, not to take us too far aside, I feel like the Disney Plus years of Pixar, they've only gotten better because they've picked a little bit more varied content. And Soul is, it's traditional Pixar in the way it looks and kind of feels, and it tells a very heartwarming story, but it takes such a different way of getting there. And their focus in the last few years on music in their movies has just taken it up a notch. I mean, the music from Coco is phenomenal. The music Soul is Coco turned to 11. Just as far as how well produced it is and how good the music stands by itself.
Well, that's awesome. I need to put that on my list. But yeah, he's always putting himself in Herbie Hancock. That is putting himself in situations that kind of demand him to evolve. And not like he's like, okay, well, I'm gonna really have to like do something different. I think there's kind of a mix of intentionality and just genuine inspiration. But like this album, for example, he had started off doing like post-bop, which is like still full of sounds and textures that you would recognize, but like harmonically, it's a little bit more out there and complex. I listened to a little bit of the album Taken Off, which was like his first one that you mentioned in like 61 or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And as he kind of progressed, he was inspired by a few different things to make this album. And the first one is the album Bitches Brew. Mm-hmm. You know, the Miles Davis album, that came out in 70. So you have somebody who everybody kind of looked to as like a paragon of what jazz is, you know, what all the stodgy jazz traditionalists believed about jazz. And then this guy just completely breaks the mold, by releasing this heavily electronic, dubbed performances, heavily edited. There are like two drummers on that album. And so you have Miles Davis kind of pushing the envelope, which inspired Hancock. Mm-hmm. And then another thing, this was kind of a fun deal. All this information, by the way, I kind of pulled from the Pitchfork review of this album, because it was almost a little bit more like a little historical blurb, mm-hmm, about it. But, you know, you mentioned, I think, briefly that Herbie Hancock has dabbled in a lot of different things. And one of his interests is electronic music. Mm-hmm. And I was excited reading about this album because I recognized the name of a composer that I learned about in one of my music history courses, which is Karlheinz Stockhausen. Who was a German composer who used like some of the first, what we would just call like synthesizer, did that. And he would like have his band, his group, like he would ask like, hey guys, can we listen to some Stockhausen, or, you know, any number of the other kind of obscure European synth composers that were doing work at the time. But the third kind of ingredient is all this great funk and soul music that was being made in the 60s and 70s. The saxophonist, one of the saxophonists who worked on Bitches Brew, his name is Bernie Maupon. He was at this benefit concert called Watt Stax, put on by Stax Records as like kind of a benefit for the Watts neighborhood, which had been through the Watts riots a few years earlier. And so at this benefit concert, the saxophonist is seeing Sly and the Family Stone, the Staple Singers. Isaac Hayes, and he's watching all these kids like just moving to the music. Mm-hmm. And so this guy who Hancock had worked with and was kind of calling up for his next session that would become Headhunters is kind of steeped in this like funk and soul. And then you have Hancock, who's also really interested in writing something that is a little less heady and heavy, but he's also super fascinated by this like really out there modal jazz and this electronic music. And so it's like such an interesting synthesis of all these kind of disparate things. And that's like something that I didn't really even think about until doing research for this episode because it's so, you know, like you said, it kind of struck you as like, okay, this is experimental jazz. Mm-hmm. But we kind of have the like handicapped position of like, this is ground that has already been trod because he did this. And so it was really interesting to read about those influences and like kind of listen to the record and go like, oh man, this is like five or six different genre ingredients mm-hmm. being just super masterfully mixed into one thing.
Yeah. You know, I think that's a good point too. One of the things about this album that kind of stuck out to me was kind of how, well, first, I was really impressed with how well produced this album is for 1973. Like, it sounds amazing today, no matter what you listen to it on. It's really clean. It really comes through as a tight mix. But there is an element to it of just kind of improvisational looseness without being like so structured that it's stifling to the music. And that kind of reminded me as I was listening to it this week and hearing him play or the different kinds of solo instruments. It brings me back to us talking about the Tim Hawkins podcast where he was dragging on Brad Paisley's kind of nonsensical solos. And we talked about that kind of at length last week. When I compare a Brad Paisley solo to a Herbie Hancock solo or any one of the musicians playing with him, I feel like the solos on this album have a lot of meaning. They make sense musically. They fit what's being played in the background. They accentuate the emotions or the story that song is trying to tell. And so it was kind of funny to me, having just had that conversation with you last week, and then hearing every one of these four tracks just has that moment where it really shines and kind of pops out at you. So I don't know what you want to say about that, but there is something that I did notice about this album that I just kind of chuckled about every time I listened to that, and it's it's kind of dated sounding. Like it is a product of 1973, and that's not a bad thing. I'm not saying, you know, this is old and I don't like it. I'm saying it sounds like it was made in 1973, and it sounds like the kind of music from 1970s, like Dragnet shows or the Dirty Harry movies or even like the Lethal Weapon yeah. movies. Like, it has that kind of funky jazz. And I'm pretty sure, I'm probably totally wrong on this, so I'm ready with the wrong buzzer. I'm pretty sure one of the tracks from this album was used in the original Gone in 60 Seconds movie during one of like the 20-minute car chases where cars are just falling apart and there's just like this smooth jazz playing while they're beating up these
fantastic.
Cars. So
yeah, your point is not, I definitely don't disagree. So I think that if you listen to jazz a lot, mm-hmm. as I do, I don't think this album comes off necessarily as dated, even though it is definitely of its time in as much as the instrumentation, the grooves. I mean, like I was talking about, this was very much a synthesis of some of the more popular music that Herbie Hancock felt motivated to make. But yeah, to your point about the soloing, it's funny you bring that up. I was watching a video and it was an interview with Bill Evans, who's like big top tier jazz pianist. And he was saying the key to jazz, the thing that makes jazz special when it's good, specifically when it comes to improvisation, is that you are learning all these really kind of technical, right-brained things when you learn jazz, because harmonically jazz is very complex. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily know enough to like delve into the music theory stuff, and I don't want to like bore people, but what you're doing when you when a musician learns jazz is you go through this long period, usually from an early age. Like I think a lot of Texas public schools have a jazz band in middle school. Mm-hmm. And so you start from middle school learning all this vocabulary to improvise. And you spend a lot of time learning, all right, these are the licks and the phrases. These are my words and sentences that fit within this context or like these chords. And so you spend all this time digesting this like knowledge, mm-hmm. right? This base of knowledge. And then the artistry comes from spending a lot of time with your peers playing and learning essentially to forget on a conscious level all that junk and just play from, I mean, it sounds so cheesy, but like to play from your heart. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is why this music and jazz specifically, I think good jazz artists do this well, excels in complex improvisation, where maybe somebody might listen to the work of insert country artist name here because I can't remember it again. That's Brad twice in this. Brad Paisley, which is not to say that Brad Paisley isn't amazingly talented, because I think that he really is. But jazz musicians traditionally spend so much time steeping themselves in performance, in improvisation. Because that was one of the things that struck me as well, is all the improvisation, no matter how technical it gets, no matter how harmonically complex, no matter how out there, it always feels like something true is being said. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the main attractors to me with this album, is that between Hancock and Maupon, the sax player, who I think he also plays like bass, clarinet, some other interesting things on this record. Man, it just all flows. It all goes somewhere. It has peaks and valleys. It really just, man, does it stick? It is just some of my favorite jazz improvisation ever.
I will say, being fairly new to jazz improvisation, I feel like I got a good exposure to it. I mean, this is definitely a name and an artist who I will be sticking to with my collection and listening to more often. I downloaded the This Is Herbie Hancock playlist to my phone, so the next time I'm without cell service, it's going to end up playing, which,
yeah, nice,
which is cool. I mean, it's really, really fun music, and even though there's only four tracks on this album, I felt like I got a full experience out of it. And yeah, the tracks are 13 minutes long in a couple of cases, but it tells a complete story. It feels like the right amount of album for what it is.
Yeah, and if you look at the length of his albums before this, they're all similarly kind of laid out, where it's 4 to 6 compositions that have improvisation and also have these kind of more organized phrases and passages. I was watching a YouTube video of the percussionist who performs a lot of the like extra stuff that isn't just the drum kit. He's the guy who did the really interesting little like whistle at the beginning of Watermelon Man. His name is Bill Summers, and he was saying like when they recorded this album, they got together and there were no charts. Mm-hmm. Herbie Hancock had, you know, all these guys came with ideas and they hashed it out bit by bit and came up with a composition after just hours and hours of playing. They had assembled this thing that had purpose and structure. They just hadn't come with like, all right, well, we're going to do this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm.
The complete opposite of the White Stripes showing up and recording something in 13 days.
Yeah, well, this album similarly did not take very long to record. I think it only took like, I want to say what I read said it was like a week. Because that's just kind of the world that a lot of like professional jazz musicians live in, is they're just playing hours and hours and hours every day doing gigs and stuff. And so I think similar to the White Stripes, they just knew what they were about and went in and did the dang thing.
And to build on that, he definitely had to know something about what he was doing going in, because the man is so friggin' prolific. He's had 42 studio albums between the years 1961 and 2010. 42. Yeah. That's 2 and 3 a year in some cases that he's dropping.
Dude and, works.
Yeah. And in addition and I think, to scoring for hundreds of TV shows, tons of movie credits. I mean, the guy is all over the place and he's still doing 2 studio albums a year.
Yeah. Yeah, he really is prolific. And I think that if you look at a lot of the great names in jazz, you will see very similar tendencies. One of the things that I think is kind of magical about jazz is that because of the proficiency of the players and kind of the depth to which they've steeped themselves in their art form, there's a lot, for one thing, there's a lot more of an ability to get together and sit in a room with your musicians all mic'd up and play and get something really excellent and really beautiful, which is not to disparage what a pop artist or like, you know, somebody like Pink Floyd who will sit around and really think out like, all right, we're going to compose the heck out of this and record every individual little track. And that's not to say that jazz artists just come in and wing it either, because they definitely don't. There's a lot of tradition. There's a lot of form. Everybody knows the technical aspect of it. I think they're just maybe able to.
Well, they're reading from the same technical manual and they've all got it down pat by heart.
So everybody's got that language. Yeah, it frees absolutely. Them
just to express and express as one, which really works. So,
And I want to, because we've talked a lot about the playing and like the music of this album, but I want to take a little bit and talk about the textures and the tones. Like the production of this album is something that just pleases me to no end. Specifically, and this is a thing that I notice in a lot of music from the late 60s into the 70s that kind of falls into this, like whether it's a fusion record or even something like Stevie Wonder's records, the production specifically of the drums and the bass is not necessarily, I think when I was typing this out, I had called it bone dry, which I don't think it is, because there's a little bit of life and ambience to the sounds, but man, it is just crisp. It's not slushy at all. There's like hardly any reverb or anything. And the bass is always mixed like to work in concert with the drums. And it makes the rhythm section and the groove just so good.
So listening
like for me personally,
listening to this on my Atom A7s earlier this week, I was really drawn by how present the recording felt. So it felt like I was sitting in a room and they were playing it live in front of me. It didn't sound like it was colored by effects or recording technology of the 70s. It just sounded like I was in a small room and I was with the drum kit. I was with the bass. And I think that's the same vibe you're getting there. It doesn't sound just kind of otherworldly or weird. It didn't have that mushy, you know, effects laden, just over compressed anything. It's right there.
Yeah. And like even the really out there in air quotes, right, out there stuff on this album, all the synths that Hancock is playing have just the right amount of out there-ness. There's like on Chameleon, for example, on the first track, He has that really crazy synthesizer solo where he's like messing with the pitch wheel and kind of going out of key for a little bit and then coming back in. Like, that tone on its own would probably be a little strident and a little irritating, but in the mix of everything, man, it's just perfect. Like, it's not too much or too little.
Well, and on top of that, what I really loved about this album and what really brought me around to this album was how real everything sounded. So even though it's an electric piano or it's a, you know, he's playing with a tone wheel, it sounds like something that he legitimately played, and it wasn't put together with loops and splicing together different effects in like Fruit Loops or whatever. Like, he played that for real, and you could feel how real that was, and that goes for every instrument on this album. So I thoroughly enjoyed his use of textures and tones throughout the whole thing, with a couple of exceptions, but that's for later. What?
Oh, okay. I was gonna say, don't leave me hanging. I'm curious. Yeah, just, and like, I think that probably some of the differences, because, you know, there's a lot of electronic music out there that is really good and really expressive, but just in different ways. Personally, I find myself drawn to music like this that I think enables a different kind of expression that has more to do with improvisation. But even if you look at the mechanics of like a Rhodes electric piano, hopefully I've got my facts right here, but it's still a hammer striking a metal tine, if I'm not mistaken. And so there is room there still for
human touch.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's not to say that other synthesizer effects don't do that. They have to do it in different ways and overcome that with, you know, the parameters of the attack and, you know, frequency sweeps. And they even have like modulation wheels where you can kind of like, you know, get a tone to like wobble basically, and get the imitation of vibrato or whatever. But I think this album is like a perfect meeting of technology and old school approach. I think that's what makes it magical, because all these guys, like the drummer had just played in a lot of like R&B and funk stuff. And so, but it, one of the things you notice listening to him play that I noticed today that I really loved is that he's taking kind of more straight ahead funk patterns and giving it the push and pull of a jazz drummer. If you listen to jazz long enough, you kind of notice like the drummer almost doesn't do the same thing twice, and yet somehow he's always keeping time. Whereas, you know, in pop music, it's the same like eight bars punctuated by fills and then moving on to a different groove or whatever. But that like old school approach and like Herbie Hancock's harmonic sensibilities, but also he's using these crazy like ARP synthesizers that nobody had really thought like, oh, we should stick that on a jazz tune. All those approaches just make this album brilliant, because it's stuff that you're familiar with, but at like a slightly different angle. And I think especially at that time, this was like mind blowing. Cause like you said, this sounds super familiar, you know, cause I definitely thought of like something really dorky, like Starsky and Hutch, you know, like
that's exactly what I thought and didn't say.
Or like, yeah, no, but I, you know, people looked at this and went like, oh, we need to just put this everywhere. You know, this Herbie Hancock, one of the quotes I've got here is that this music really, here's a quote from him. He said, sure, I'm getting a bigger white audience, but I'm also getting a big black audience, which I never had. I've finally been able to come out with some music that the general black public can relate to. Because jazz, I think, has always had like kind of a narrower fan base to begin with. And it's always been like the quintessential black American art form. But because he was looking at all these different kind of more publicly consumed art forms, let's say, mm-hmm. he was able to say, okay, I understand that from this angle. And it just creates this really fascinating, just really electrifying set of tracks. I can't, like, in case listeners, in case you haven't realized, like, I'm like freaking out about this album because it's been one of my favorites for a while. And just like digging into the nuts and bolts of it, I was like, man, it really is something else.
Well, I do want to go back one second because you saying that reminded me of wanting to talk a little bit more about the drum set used for this album. There is a lot of percussion. There's a lot of alternative percussion instruments. But when you get to thinking about the drum set here, this isn't like Lars Ulrich's 87 floor toms and 9 million different kinds of cymbals. Like, it's a really stripped down, tight drum set. I mean, you got a snare, a tom, a kick drum, and maybe, you know, a hi-hat, of course, but a couple of other, you know, minor drums that aren't even really featured anywhere in it. I mean, this is a really basic kit, and it's played wonderfully throughout the whole album.
Yeah, and that's another thing that attracts me to this kind of music. And, you know, like, fusion basically being what this is. Like, fusion goes in a lot of different directions. You have bands like Weather Report, where the drummer does have 1,000 toms and, you know, a cymbal for like every like diameter you could imagine, right? But
Phil Collins takes offense.
Phil Collins wishes he were good enough to play this kind of music. Exactly. Phil Collins, he is good at other things. Drumming on this level is not what he's good at. But, you know, there were all these different approaches birthed from this album, but this is, to me, the most satisfying because, and using the drums as the example like you're talking about, it's making the most of a smaller set of tools, basically. Even with the synthesizer stuff, you know, if you compare it to what people have access to today, well, I mean, shoot, what Herbie Hancock has access to today, because he's still making music. But, you know, there were maybe less bells and whistles, and the only limit was Herbie Hancock's imagination. And what he was able to do in this album is just so, like, just so incredible for the amount of, and I keep bringing up him, but the whole band is amazing. One of the things I love about Watermelon Man, no, not Watermelon Man, about Chameleon, is that bass line at the beginning of the song is a synth line that Herbie Hancock is playing. So what the bassist comes in with, Paul Jackson, what he comes in with sounds like a guitar line. It's the kind of thing that a guitarist in like in a funk band would be playing. And then there's another moment in Watermelon Man. One of the things in this album, just as a feature, is that Herbie Hancock decided, I'm not going to do guitars on this album. It's just going to be whatever I can do on keys and whatever the wind player can do on his instrument. And so he uses, it's either clavichord or clavinet. I can't remember which it is. But he uses that, which is another kind of electric keyboard instrument, with a wah pedal. And it sounds just like a guitar. Half the time I'm listening to that track, I think like, oh man, that's a great guitar part. And then I remember like, no, there's no guitar on this album. It's a trick that Stevie Wonder does also for the same kind of motivations in some of his albums, where he's like, you know what? Guitar player's annoying, because we are. We're kind of big-headed, pompous jerks. And says, I can do all that myself, and does. And golly, man, the effect of it is just fantastic. It's so good.
I agree. And I think, unless you've got something else to talk about, we need to move on to our reviews, the critical reviews. I gotta be honest, there is no Metacritic rating for this album.
Yeah, like, it's
what a disappointment.
The thing I do want to bring up that I think is important enough to like do like a tire squeal in the parking lot real quick. So this album has a lot of really interesting African influences, both in the album cover and the music itself. So Hancock's projects before this, he referred to as being part of his Mwandishi period. One of the albums was named Mwandishi, and it's the Swahili word for composer. The album artwork, which is kind of iconic, it's one of my favorite album covers, actually, features a ritual mask worn in dances that the Boule people of the Ivory Coast wear. And what's kind of cool about that mask is they've replaced some of the face elements. Like, they kind of made a mock-up themselves, I think. And it's got, like, old-school analog recording equipment. Like, I think the eyes are a couple of knobs.
The eyes are volume knobs, and the mouth is a VU meter turned upside down.
And, if you want, and this might be a stretch, but I'm going to go ahead and make this comparison, because I think that this is probably a lot of the meaning behind it. If you think about the Black American experience and people's ancestors being ripped from their homes and taken to this new place and enslaved, and all being freed, but not really, because of Jim Crow and those kind of things. If you think about the roots of tradition being melded with kind of the demands of modern life, that's kind of what that mask represents. And that could be construed, it could be kind of a stretch, but when you also look at a song like Watermelon Man, where it begins, I mentioned the percussionist Bill Summers. He was imitating the sound of a two-note whistle used by the Mbuti Pygmies of Zaire. And so that track, Watermelon Man, opens with those sounds, and they kind of fade into the background as a more modern track pops up, which is itself like a riff on, an older tune that Hancock had composed, and then fades out back into that little whistle. I think a fair analysis of it would be kind of talking about the Black experience in America as a whole as having this idea, this identity that is, dealing with these problems in modern life, but also having this really strong identity that has to do with being from Africa. And I just think that is one of the like richer parts of this album. And then you start to look at all the music that Hancock and company were influenced by. It just, it makes this, if it were just the music, it would be enough. But I think it's worth pointing out that this is an album that has something to say about being Black and being part of a music that Black Americans created and pioneered. And I say all this just to point it out, because I think for myself and for a lot of white music fans, it's easy to go that music's great. But I think it's important to, at the very minimum, at least educate yourself on where this music comes from, the influences that the music is drawing on. And I think that knowledge, when you learn things, I think a lot of times you can't help but be changed by what you're learning about. And so at least to have that as a starting point. And that's not to say learning about bands that you love is going to change the world, but knowledge is a good starting point. And so I just wanted to point that out because I think it enriches the whole thing.
Very good, man. Well, short of a Pitchfork review, which gave this 10 out of 10, and was basically a look back on why it's such an important album, we kind of came up dry at that well. So let's do our own reviews then. Let's talk about what we liked about this album or didn't like. And to remind our audience, we use guitar strings 1 through 6, even though there's a disturbing lack of guitar strings here. Not.
It's on a scale of 1 to 82 keys or whatever it is on a keyboard.
On a full keyboard, 88. Sir.
I'm a bad music major. I was just leaving off those top keys because I personally don't know what to do with them anyway. I'm a guitarist. I only have 6 strings to work with.
Those are the only keys Beethoven ever used. Come on, man. Yeah.
The ones at the very bottom at the ones at the very top and just like everything all the time. But do you want to go first or do you want me to? How do you want to do this here?
I'll go first. Right. That way you get the last word on the album. For me, this album was really easy to review. And I say that without being like flippant or lighthearted about it. Usually the review section of this podcast is the part that really makes me stop and ask questions and really figure out why I'm being so critical of something. And it was so easy for me to review because the first time I heard it, you know, on Sunday last week, I knew that I liked it. And then the question became, how much do I like this album? Not what's wrong with it or what's, you know, I didn't have that immediate knee-jerk reaction to, well, I don't like this one thing about it or whatever. So with that said, Herbie Hancock is prolific. We've said it. My notes here, 41 studio albums. The man in his 60-year career has won 14 Grammys from his different jazz compositions over the years. And this album, while being relatively early in his career, is a mere taste of the excellence that he has to offer. Like I said, I ended up listening to that entire Herbie Hancock playlist on Spotify. And over the years, seeing how he's reimagined himself and innovated on his own style and his own playing and with the tools that he uses, it's just kind of mind-blowing to see this as some of his earlier roots versus where he ended up going with his career all the way up to that writing credit on Pixar's Soul. And when it comes down to it, all that music is great and everything's wonderful. But when you boil it back down to this, to Headhunters, the album, it's a beautiful hodgepodge of sounds and textures and interweaving storylines that even though there's no lyrics anywhere here, I walked away feeling like I understood what was trying to be conveyed. I felt emotionally attached to it, connected to it. And yeah, I feel like it's a little dated in bits and pieces. Music has moved on from where this is, where this was recorded. Tiffany, when we were listening to it that first time, jokingly turned to me and said, "It sounds like we're waiting on a plumber to show up and fix our pipes." And after that, she took it back because I was like, "Excuse me? No."
That's fantastic.
But with that kind of said, I feel like there is just nothing that I can really hate on about this album. I feel like it's just the right mix of the heritage of jazz music and the future of jazz music. It's a homage to what jazz music was, is, and has become since then. I feel like it's pure musical excellence and expression across the board. And so since Herbie plays keys and there's 88 of them on a piano, I fact checked that after having played it for years poorly. I'm going to say that this gets every last key. It's 88 keys, 6 out of 6 strings, and a great percussion line right behind it.
I love it. Well, I don't even know how much more I could add with my review. I got to say, like, every time I listen to this album at work, you know, I'm sitting on my butt on a forklift seat most of the day. But man, whenever I put this album on, my head would start bobbing and I would like get the dude from Hitch, the like, you know, keep it right here, you know, like side to side or whatever. Like, I could not help but move around. I mentioned the rhythm section, but I'll just say their names because they're worth saying. Paul Jackson, Harvey Mason, and Bill Summers are a rhythm section to beat all rhythm sections. And it's their work on this album is almost something that I would occasionally just listen to by itself and not really pay attention to the other elements because it was so good. We talked about Hancock and Maupin's improvisations. They're equally parts technically proficient and imbued with emotion and life. Like when I was writing this little review, I kept returning to that word life, lively. It's their improvisation is never indulgent. You know, it's not like they're trying to show off or put on a clinic. Every lick is just expressive and true. And I think this album is really bold. The compositions are lively. This album really feels like it's a breathing, blood-filled entity. It's 100% jazz in its harmonic content, but it feels visceral the way funk music does. And as far as like stylistic achievements go, this album for me is aspirational. You know, I don't know if I'll ever blend up all my influences into something as meaningful, but I am sure going to keep trying. So 88 out of 88 keys for me, or 6 out of 6 strings, but like the 6 out of 6 stringiest review, I think that we've gotten, which is appropriate because it's the 20th episode. And, we kind of, the Oracle pushed us into like a really great album to review for this like little milestone of ours.
Absolutely, man. Well, I think that's great. What was your favorite and least favorite track?
So it would be ridiculous to pick a least favorite track. Because I like all of them, and it's a 4-track record. So like
throw away 25% of it right off the bat.
Yeah, no, there's no way. But my favorite track is definitely Watermelon Man. And I wouldn't call it a cover. It's a reinterpretation because Herbie Hancock wrote the song, you know, so he can do what he wants with it. But man, like every time this song comes on, I get excited. Like I mentioned earlier, he rejected guitars outright on this album. And his like solution to that self-imposed puzzle is just like so clever and simple to me of just like, occasionally have the bass play in an upper register or use clavinet with a wah pedal. Like that's just brilliant to me. And also like, if you kind of like AB the original versus this one, like Maupin's take on the melody is a little sparse. Like it's not quite as, there aren't as many notes or as many like rhythmic figures, but you can definitely hear the original melody coming through. And it's just like another example of whatever the opposite of a music sin is. You know, we have our mm-hmm. 7 deadly sins. This is like a saintly practice. I don't know, but the whole, the one of the 7 lively virtues of music is keep it simple, stupid. And in a lot of ways, that's what he does with that melody. And I just love it. So it's for sure my favorite is Watermelon Man. What about you? Did you have a favorite or was it too hard to choose?
So I really don't have a favorite or least favorite. Earlier in the review, I talked about having elements of the album that I didn't like. And this is going to sound terrible, but I came to this discussion with an element in mind that I really disliked. And then mm-hmm. throughout the course of our conversation here tonight, I've been educated in what that element was. And I have to reevaluate it kind of from that lens instead of the lens I was coming at it. So I'm going to read to you what I described it as here without going and looking. And it's the intro and outro from Watermelon Man, which I described as a pan flute with an inhale retrohale syncopation.
I love it. Well, he improvised that on a bottle, so it may have been something that he was doing relatively simple. It was an instrument he'd heard and was just replicating. So your assessment is probably pretty close.
But hearing the intention behind it and what he was trying to recreate makes a whole lot more sense than what I came away with no understanding. Just hearing it, it was kind of, with no understanding, it comes across as just kind of this obnoxious, do nothing, go nowhere, just repeating,
kind of thing. I can see, like, there's not a whole lot of stuff that we hear like that in your everyday listening. Like,
it takes so long developing is part of the problem. If it had been like at the ending where it's like four bars of it and it's gone, cool. Uh-huh. But at the beginning, it's like 32 bars of just it's like, how much of this can I put up with?
I think it's interesting. I think that musicians probably have a lot more tolerance for that kind of thing than non-musicians do. And you're kind of in a middle ground because you played piano and you like listen to music with a more critical ear than just like some dude turning on the radio.
But I'm not obviously a musician.
Yeah. So it's, I can understand that thing, but like for me, I kind of like obnoxious sounds or sounds that bother other people, which
that's
I don't
why our
think
friendship works. I'm obnoxious and you put up with it.
No, what I was gonna say, and I don't even remember. So for a while I had a Yamaha keyboard that my mom had given me, and it eventually broke or something, but I remember one of the first, this is a good story for, since Megan and I have our anniversary today. On a lot of those Yamaha keyboards, you have sound effects, like kind of in the upper, like 200 or 300 of the like sound settings. And one of them is like a screaming person.
And please, I tell remember me there was a sitting Wilhelm scream somewhere on that thing.
It sounded like one, but I was playing, because they just mapped that sound onto each note on the keyboard. And so I remember vividly sitting in our back room in our first apartment playing Jingle Bells with the screaming voice lady and Megan coming in being like, "What? Dear God, please stop. What on earth are you doing?
We won't make it to 1 year, much less 9 if you keep that up."
Well, I stopped mostly because the keyboard broke. But anyway, I can see how that would like really kind of rub you the wrong way. But like I said, I enjoy like those really odd sounds. And so I'm glad that you at least like, I'm glad you learned something. Also no pressure.
And honestly, I gave the album 6 out of 6 strings. Like, that's the one thing that bugged me out of the whole thing. It's like, come on, that's a minor thing in the grand scheme of things. So
yeah, that makes sense. All right. Well, would you like to hit up the Oracle for a cookie and an album to listen to this coming week?
Yeah, let's figure it out. We're picking from my list, which has 35 numbers on it. Here we go. Number 22, Jack Johnson, In Between Dreams, 2005.
We're going to get super chill next week and kick back with like a mojito or something.
Hey, that man can play the guitar like nobody's business. So it's going to be a fun discussion.
Yeah. I'm excited because I've heard all the songs everybody has heard by Jack Johnson, but I haven't listened to a full blown album. So I'm excited to give this album a listen. Okay, folks. Well, thank you so much for listening. If you've been enjoying our show, please rate it and review it. We are always interested in hearing your feedback, and we might even read your reviews or comments on air.
Speaking of reviews, Chris, we got a new review this past Wednesday, a 5-star review from user Steady as the Morning, who said, "Loved the deer and beer episode. Good to hear how learning the context and intention can change a 1-string to a 4-string. If we apply that mindset to people, our capacity for compassion and empathy would skyrocket."
Oh, man, that's fantastic.
Yeah,
I wonder if I know who that is. I might know who that is.
Well, the title of their album was Good Name for a Pub. So
nice. I like it.
Anyhow, So that was the first time we've read a review. We will do it for real, folks. I mean it.
We will.
If you want to get in touch with us, shoot us an email at twodudesandtunes@gmail.com, all spelled out. And don't forget to hit us up on Instagram or Facebook. Tell us what you thought about Headhunters. And don't forget to tune in next Wednesday when we talk about having a breakdown, eating banana pancakes, and getting better together. We'll see you next week, everyone.